Welcome to the Atwell Podcast.
All right, well, I guess let's begin. Welcome to the Atwell Podcast. More than likely, if I have something to say after I ask you a question, you go into it, I'll just sort of raise my hand there. And then just whenever you can, let me interject, I guess.
Yep.
Awesome. Okay.
No problems.
Mr. Thanks, Norton, appreciate you being on. You are a hedge fund manager. How long have you been a hedge fund manager?
So we started the fund actually just around the time COVID hit. So not a great time to start, not able to go out and network, but that's when we started it. It was years in planning. So my partner and I in the fund, we've been designing trades together for over a decade now, certainly several years before the fund. And obviously it's a big leap to then go up and try and set up a hedge fund in that kind of situation. But yeah, it's hard. It's a very competitive industry.
So when you trade, are you trading on American markets or solely on Australian markets?
No, we are predominantly on American, but you know, other global markets, but not Australia, actually. No. So my partner in the fund is based in Canada, but we're both sort of global traders, really, rather than local.
Are you dealing with mainly stocks, or are you messing with any forex or anything like that?
I tend not to trade currencies. We have our trades are quite systematic. We have a certain style that we're looking for, a certain theme that we want to achieve for the fund, which is to have sort of zero correlation with equities. But we'll, at the moment, the strategies that we have are based on US stock indices. They're option trades primarily. We have some statistical arbitrage trades, which are on global indices. And we have a trade on the VIX, using VIX options. We probably will extend out into U.S. stocks as well at some point too, or stock options on options on U.S. stocks at some point too.
Yeah, sure. So why do you want zero correlation with currencies? Is there a reason for that?
Zero correlation with equities, because basically there's virtually no one that can do it. So there are some macro funds that achieve that. So some global macro funds will, you know, can achieve zero correlation with equities. But the hedge fund industry, its correlation with equities over the years has just continued to increase. So now hedge fund industry in general is correlating, you know, way over 70%, probably going to move towards 80% with equities. And we feel that actually doesn't help investors. You know, the whole point originally for hedge funds was to give something different to equity investors. And the closer they correlate to equities, in our opinion, they're not giving investors what they want. Now, the flip side of that is the funds that just hedge for tail risk or things like that, you know, for crashes. But we think that there's a middle ground that no one really is able to do and hasn't done. There's very few funds like us that we can achieve roughly zero correlation to the US equities in any market conditions, whether market, you know, equities go up or down. So we feel that reducing that correlation risk is something that, you know, investors should be attracted to. And it's something that we specialize in because, yeah, you know, so it's not just about performance. If we just go on performance and just have a statistical arbitrage fund or whatever and go on performance, then you're in that game where you have a good quarter, you get funds, you have a bad quarter, you lose funds. But if we have our basis where we end up with, you know, decent performance, but roughly zero correlation to equities, there's very few funds that can do that. And that's the playing field that we want to fight people on.
Right. So as an Australian trading in the American markets, is there any worry about America's financial state as it relates to the debt that we have?
No, I think generally people, I wouldn't say necessarily comfortable with the debt, but it's not a huge concern. I think it's more, you know, sort of a political concern in the US. There's usually usually governments will get around to moving the debt to a place where it's comfortable. But if the debt was a problem, the bond market will be telling you that. And the bond market's not telling you that it's a problem.
How would the bond market tell you that? That's really interesting.
So bond investors wouldn't want to buy US debt. If they thought the debt was a real problem, and they're, you know, I do hear things out there about people saying about, oh, you know, debt's going to crash and the US economy and that. Well, the people wouldn't be buying US bonds, right? They're yielding 4.3% right now. They were, yielding, 5% closer to that recently. So they've actually, you've seen that coming down. I don't think that investors around the world are worried about a debt crisis at the moment in the US, not at all.
That's really interesting. I wanted to get an outside perspective. And honestly, as an American, obviously, we're looking at the debt more scared. I've talked to corporate bankers here recently. They've been on the podcast where they're saying that it's a serious problem. However, what you're saying honestly makes a little more sense because if the cash flow for America is right and people are still buying the debt, and maybe it's not as big as issue as what we say. I don't believe that that'll ever be paid, but it's really, I haven't heard that yet. So.
Yeah, I mean, and the debt doesn't have to be paid. It's not a mortgage, right? And people that compare it to a mortgage, it's not like that. It's different. But if you go back to, for example, crises in Europe, right? You go back, how many years ago was that now? But Portugal, Greece, remember that, a number of years ago, their debt got out of control to a point where the world thought, you do have a problem with paying that back, right? And there's been crisis in my time. I've been trading now for 35 plus years. I've seen crisis in Asia, a similar situation where debt was out of control, and the market basically told you that, right? They yields on bonds went through the roof, and it got to the point where they had to, essentially restructure. US is nowhere near that. It's not near that at all. The bond market has it seems to be very comfortable with the US debt at the moment.
No. And that's even for Australians. So, do you have to pay any kind of extra fee, being out of country to buy the bonds?
No, I mean, I personally don't own US bonds. But for foreigners, I think foreigners are reasonable owners of US bonds. Always have been, and sometimes that's because of, trade situation with the US countries in particular, right? That have trade surpluses with the US might use some of those dollars to buy US bonds as well. And there's really no stopping them for that. And it's a good source of
Cash flow.
investor for the US bonds. I mean, that's fine. It's part of that's
Yeah.
the way that the world works.
Yeah. 4%, four, I think you said 4.5% maybe.
4.3 right now for 10 years, yeah.
Yeah, that's not bad. And certificates of deposit through bank, this is maybe not so much for investors, but for just regular people who just want to go and put some money in the bank. They're paying 5%, some even close to
Wow.
6%. So that's really good. And you got to let the money set. But I mean, really, for basically a zero risk, the only risk you have is inflation. You're not going to be able to beat that, you can't change it. So for people who's not in the market, 6% looks pretty good. $600 on 10,000, it's not bad. I'm going to ask you a whole bunch of questions because this is something that I never traded options. So why don't you
Okay.
tell me a little bit about options, how you're trading, what you're trading, what the risk versus reward is, just go into a whole thing on it.
Okay, so options have become extremely popular, particularly in the retail industry. And I'm glad you asked the question because there's a lot of misrepresentation of options out there, and I think they have the potential to really hurt people if they use them the wrong way. Used correctly, options are a fantastic product. I love options. We use them in the fund, but we have certain rules, and I've always had these certain rules over my career, and I prefer to be long options. So if you own an option, you have essentially, huge upside potential and very limited downside, right? You can only lose what you've paid for an option. I like that profile of a trade. I like to risk a little bit and potentially make a lot. Now, in the retail world, there are a lot of influencers out there right now who are telling retail traders that you should sell options. And there are all sorts of misleading reasons why they do it. So if you sell an option, you receive the premium for that option. But that's all you can ever make. And if you're wrong and the market moves, in a big way against you, you're up for potentially big losses.
Yeah,
So for
unlimited, really.
me, sorry.
Unlimited losses, basically the
Yep.
same way as a short.
Exactly. Yep. And there's all sorts of things that they say to these influencers. They'll say things like, "Oh, the vast majority of options expire worthless." So therefore, when you sell options, the most of the time you're going to win. But that's a very misleading comment. Okay, for a few reasons. And if you're, if people out there are persuaded to sell options for that reason, it is flawed. It's significantly flawed. And then there are strategies as well, which are kind of like a hybrid strategy, like covered calls, which are often marketed towards equity investors, where you own equities and you sell call options out of the money on that. And again, it's sort of classed as a win-win that if the stock goes up, well, you've got the stock, you'll sell the stock against the calls that were exercised. And if the stock goes down, you receive the premium. But again, it's a little bit, I'm not saying it's a terrible strategy. There are times where covered calls are okay. But the other situation of it is if you frame it differently, a covered call is essentially a strategy where you're limiting the upside because you're selling the call option, but you own all of the downside if that stock collapses. And yeah, you receive a little bit of extra premium to help you. And so this is something that I've always been quite passionate about. The influencers out there are generally telling people to sell options. And I think it's misguided. I have certain rules with trading, and rule number one is preservation of capital. And essentially, like rule number two, following on from that, is you don't want to be doing trades that have the potential to blow you up in one day. I've seen it. I've seen traders blow up. I've seen, investment bank desks blow up on one day. Okay. And the reason why I've been here for 35 years is because I've spent, a long time, all my time trying to make sure that I, don't have that event. If I buy options and there's some unusual event happens, I'm most likely going to profit from it. If you sell options and there's some unusual event, and every few years there is an unusual event, there is something that happens, and they happen more regularly than the options model normally prices. So I think they're a great product in certain ways to use them. If you think there could be a big move, if you want to use put options to hedge equity portfolios, for example, if you did that a few weeks ago, that's a great thing to do when equities started to look a little bit dangerous. And there's sort of some, incohesive kind of policies coming out of the new administration. People got nervous. If you wanted to hedge your portfolio, they're brilliant for that. And for if you think that there's could be a big move in a market, great, that buy options, you have a great payoff potential. If you want to sell options, you need to be extremely careful. And I often say it's a bit like trying to walk across a road blindfold. You may be able to do it once, twice, three times, but eventually it's going to catch up with you and you're going to get run over. If you keep selling options, the most likely scenario is at some point you will get smashed.
I've seen, to your point, a lot of people blow up accounts. I watched people, and it's always, well, there's probably a word for it, and I'm missing it right now. But when someone's in a losing trade, it's like the pride hits, and they want to either average down. I'm like, why are you averaging down in this trade when you were wrong to begin with? If you're wrong, get out. You set a stop loss, do something, guys. But instead, they want to add to a losing position. And I saw a guy, I'm not kidding you, had a SPAC, special acquisition company for people who don't know. It listed at like $10 and it goes to $17. So he's in huge and gains. He held that stock all the way till it hit 25 cents, lost
Yeah, it's
everything.
terrible.
And there's a special psychology there when you're losing that you don't want to admit it. And maybe it's more primal pride, but I have seen a lot of people make some really terrible decisions.
Yeah, the behavioral finance people will tell you that's the cognitive dissonance coming in, right? It's that you don't want to admit it. And if you don't sell it, you're not admitting you've made a mistake. So they think that if they hold it, and then you get other biases as well, called like the status quo bias, which is essentially doing nothing is people's default position when faced with problems. Whereas actually it's the opposite. If you're faced with a situation, do something. I always say do something. And you're right. I mean, in that person with the SPAC, I mean, this industry really, and I've said this a lot, people think trading's about prediction. It's not about prediction. And people that are trying to sell indicators and things like that, no, that's not what this business is about. This business is a risk management business. And as much as anything, it's about how you manage positions and how you manage risk. So you have a a trade, you bought it for $10, it's gone to 17. You bring up a trailing stop if you want to protect at least half your profits, right? If it comes back down to 14, I'm out, right? I've collected, I've met, things like that. That position management is really important. And I've seen this in real time with traders that I've mentored, where you can give the same trade to three different traders and you'll get three different outcomes. And this was interesting. This is a genuine real story of a few months ago. I'm mentoring some traders in China, and there was a trade where to short dollar yen. And this is three genuine traders. Now, one of them sized the trade incorrectly. Okay, so put the trade on in too big size. It was too big. And so what happens is, you're going to be very lucky if you actually, the moment you sell, in this case, dollar yen, it just goes down. There could be some wriggle room, right? It goes up against you for a little bit. If you position size incorrectly, this person got kicked out of the trade. They hit the stop loss because they were position size too big, out of the trade. Now, the other two position size correctly, so that move didn't take them out. It then fell sharply. Okay, they're both in profit. One of them had a trailing stop and one of them didn't. Now, there were some comments out of the Bank of Japan that sent the dollar yen the other way. Now, the person with the trailing stop who moved it down as the market went down, as the dollar yen went back up, took them out of the trade, they made a healthy profit. The third person who didn't use a trailing stop, dollar yen essentially went back to where it came from, ended up with no profit. So we have three people do exactly the same trade and end up with three completely different outcomes. And that's a great example of what this business is really about. It's really about position management and risk management. And people think it's about guessing market direction. It's all about prediction. No, it's not. Not at the professional level, not at the best level. If you position size correctly, if you manage your risk correctly, that's what's important. I could have three losers in a row of 1% and then one winner of 7%, and I'm making money, right? I'm doing all right. So, I think it's really important for people to understand that, the idea that we have to become big, good predictors of market, that's very hard to do day in, day out, continually predict market. And it's out of our control, right? We don't control the markets. We can't control the markets, but I can control the amount of risk I have in the market. I can control where my stop loss is, whether I use trailing stops. So they're the things that I could control. They're the things I should control. And they're actually the things that are going to drive my P&L.
I really like the trailing stop idea. I have a friend who's in the markets, and my wife, she's back to being healthy, and I'm thinking very seriously about getting back in the markets as well. But I don't advise him per se, but I definitely talk to him a lot about his trades, and he'll ask me my opinions. And one thing that I was trying to tell him relates directly to position size, and I was like, "Hey man," I was like, "Listen, like, your size, it seems like you're all over the place. You're in five different trades, the same kind of setup, but you're in it with different levels of capital every single time. So your profit and loss, your numbers are going to be all over the place. You got to spreadsheet this and try to go in with different levels of trade with the same amount of capital so that you can keep your losses around the same." So in other words, if you lose 3%, but you're trading double the size, well, now that your 5% winner is a loss, your negative loss, you're in the losses at the end of it. And I think position sizing is critical. I've been in positions where I'm in way too much in as it relates to my account, and I have literally had my hands sit there and shake because of what's going on in my brain. So, can you tell me
Even
a
at the
little bit
highest
of
level, sorry, I was just going to say, even at the highest level, if you read the book on Renaissance Capital, they'll say that that's one of the largest hedge funds in the world, tens of billions or so. But they'll say that they struggled until they nailed position sizing. And when they nailed position sizing was when the fund was really able to move forward. And you will adjust positions in more volatile conditions. You may reduce your position, right? And when things are calm and trending and stable, you may increase your position. But position sizing, as you say, is essential. It's a key part of the business.
So, do you have any rules when it comes to position sizing for whatever capital you're dealing with in your hedge fund? Like, let's just say you're dealing with 10 million. Are you only trading with 1 or 2 million at a time, or do you have any rules there?
And look, this is an area where We are constantly working on it. It's like probably every hedge fund is. It's one thing to work on your strategy. It's another thing to work on position sizing. So if a strategy starts to underperform, at what point do you reduce the allocation to that particular strategy? These are questions that you're constantly dealing with, and it's never one definite scenario. Every fund will probably have its own thing. And from our perspective, we continually work on improving that. If a strategy starts to perform better, you obviously want to allocate more to it. In that sense as well. And you're just continually trying to, get some sort of a balance correct in that sense. It's a never ending process of reevaluation and readjustment.
I've seen a lot of people come with a regular round figure, like, okay, well, don't ever use more than 10% of your capital in a trade. I've seen a lot of people come up with their own plan. What I would say is, and you've already mentioned, I would say don't use over, 30, 40% of your capital in a trade, because if you're really wrong, if you have the worst day that's possible, you're still in the game, I guess. For lack of a better word, you're still involved. You're not out. And,
Yeah, I think it's whatever capital you allocate and however leveraged you are, it's about what are you prepared, to lose or to risk on that trade. So, I could allocate, $1 million to a trade, but I might only be risking 100K, right? And if the loss gets to 100K, I'm out. For retail traders, I would say usually you don't want to lose more than 2% of your account on one trade. Now, how much you allocate, and that's how you start to design your stop losses and things like that, is look at the capital, look at your stop loss, and then refer it back. Does that stop loss there mean that with this capital, I will lose more than 2%? And if it possible, if it hits your stop loss and you will lose 10% of your account, you're trading in too big a size. So you either got to reduce your size or move your stop loss higher. But if you move your stop loss too close, it'll get triggered too quickly. So I think you've got to expect as a trader, you will have times where you have four or five losses in a row. So ask yourself, if I lose four or five in a row, what am I losing in my account? And if you're risking 10% of your account on a trade and you have five losses, you're in bad shape at the end of that. You're now going to need to double your new account to get near to where you were before. I think it is important to make sure, again, it's about managing risk. And, this comes into another thing that I think, again, you have to understand the game that you're playing. And trading is an infinite game, and people play it in the wrong way. So there's a very good book about this idea of infinite games and finite games. And I think a lot of, a finite game is like a sports game, for example, right? The game itself has a beginning and an end. So there's a game, it finishes. So there's a winner, there's a loser. In finite games, there's a winner and a loser. Now the game stops, but the players will play another game, like next week or whatever it will be. Okay. That's a finite game, and that's sports. And there's a lot of people that talk about winning as trader. You need to win. You win in finite games like basketball, like American football, like soccer, etc. But trading isn't a finite game. It's the opposite. It's an infinite game. So an infinite game is one where the game never stops, but the players do. The players drop in and out. So traders come in, they lose, they come out, they come. So in a finite game, the players keep going, but the game stops. But in an infinite game, the game keeps going. Whether I drop out tomorrow doesn't make any difference, right, to the game. Like, if trading keeps going, life is an infinite game. People come in and people go, but life carries on. Now, in an infinite game, which trading is, you can't win. I don't wake up tomorrow, right, as a trader and say, I've won. Whereas if I play a football game, I can say, yeah, I won or I lost or whatever. But in trading, that doesn't happen. So in an infinite game, the mentality that I teach when I teach traders is you just want to be here tomorrow. Staying in the game is the game. Right. And that's why I talk about grind mentality. You need to grind this out. It's an infinite game. So the number one goal, like I said, to preserve your capital, stay in the game. Stop thinking you can win. Stop thinking if I have a good day tomorrow, I've won, because you will not win. You can't, there's no winning in this game. And the number of traders who tomorrow will make $10 million and retire is a tiny fraction of a fraction of a percent, right? So it's not going to happen. Get into the right mentality. And if you come into this game with the wrong mentality, you're playing the wrong game. And that's what I see, when I teach traders, in my Norton method or whatever, I really need to make sure that they understand what the mentality of this game is first. Otherwise, they play the wrong game.
Yeah. And you said the Norton method. Is that a book that you might have wrote, or is that like a teaching, or what is that?
Yeah, it's a course that I've written. So I have a very unique style of it's sort of scalping, it would be called in some ways, futures. So it in and out of trades very quickly. It's something I developed when I left the trading floor, the pits of the London Exchange back in the late 90s. The markets went computerized. I started to develop ways of trading in that fast-paced way, in a way that suits a retail trader trading with limited capital. So in and out of trades very quickly, a few seconds. Try to make 20, 30, $50 on a trade and do it like 20, 30, 50 times a day. So you're not risking too much. You're never in the market too long. You don't need too much capital. The sorts of things that I think the way that retail traders should trade, not trying to predict where we're going to be in an hour's time, because a tweet could come out at any moment and destroy that right now, and at any time. So again, when I take people on in that method, there's videos and stuff. And the first thing is make sure you have the right mentality, because without that, and I do see retail traders who have been enticed by influencers, come in and say, oh, how much can I make? And it's all about this. And look, it's going to take time. It's a hard process. You've got to grind. You've got to be prepared to grind. And frankly, I talk about the difference between pros and amateurs a lot as well. To trade at a professional level does require an element of concentration, intensity that some amateurs are not comfortable with. We all, we'll play sport. I might play golf on the weekend. I'm an amateur. I'm clearly an amateur as a golfer, right? And I don't know how to play at that intensity. I couldn't, even if I had the skill set. The problem with trading is, you will always, I can play, sorry, as a golfer, I can play against other amateur golfers and still have fun, right? Because we're all amateurs. But when you trade in the markets, you're trading against pros. And if you're trading like an amateur with an amateur mindset, an amateur skill set, you're going to get smashed. So, I really try to, make sure people understand this game, understand the right mentality, play the right game, understand your role in the markets. You're small fish, don't try and, oh, what are the big guys doing? Just forget that, right? They're playing a different game. Play your game, play it well, and have the right mindset.
I always tell everybody to have a plan when they go into stocks, and I think a lot about that. Everyone has to have their own niche, something that they're good at, and stick to that. And you've got to spreadsheet trades. I do not understand why. I've seen it so many times. People make a trade, they'll make a $10,000 to $20,000 trade, and they don't even review it. They're not journaling. They're not journaling was huge for me. I was writing down what my mindset was going into a trade, what my thoughts was during the time that I'm involved in the trade, and after, looking at the technicals, looking at what I traded on, my method, I guess you could say. Not really a method, but just my way of trading. And I see so many people that don't do that, and they end up losing because the inputs are totally different from trade to trade. The psychology of it matters. The technicals matter to some degree. Let's talk about the technicals a little bit. How much do you think the technicals matter in stocks for what you're seeing?
So if you're really referring to like what is in the industry used as sort of technical analysis and that sort of thing, that kind of thing, I don't agree with it at all. So on that technical side, I don't use it at all. I don't think they drive markets. I think people see patterns and situations and want to see that. As humans, we like patterns. I don't think that's what happens. I mean, at the end of the day, markets are, in a simplistic term, it's about demand and supply. And the sentiment of people. And I don't believe that the technical indicators and the technical solutions out there actually tell you what's really happening. I prefer to look at the data itself. I prefer to look at, using correlations, using markets, and try to understand a picture, put the picture together. What's the picture telling you? And then position size accordingly. So I don't worry about technicals at all. I don't like them, and I don't use them.
So are you looking at volume and order flow? Is that one of the things that you're looking at? Or what indicators, like walk me through a trade that looks like a really good trade and one that you've been profitable on recently.
So again, we'll depend on whether or what style of trading. So, for example, the Norton method trading, which is not used in a hedge fund, but because it's too short term. But the Norton
Okay.
method trading is essentially a study of liquidity and trying to pick off badly placed orders. We're holding trades for 3 or 4 seconds. So what we know is there's a lot of retail traders in, for example, the ES market or NQ futures, who are pretty poorly skilled. And there's enough of them that there are times that they make mistakes. We understand that we can pick them off. So that's a very different style of trading. And as I say, we try to pick them off literally in a couple of seconds, but essentially poorly placed trades.
Yeah, I just got one quick question. So when you're dealing with those scalping trades, obviously you got to have extremely fast internet. But my biggest question that comes to mind is, as it relates to retail, is how does the PDT work across countries? I know some countries there is no PDT. Is there a PDT in Australia?
No, I mean, people trade the US markets from all over the world. There's no problem at all.
Yeah. So
No issues.
the
We can trade directly with US brokers as well if we want to, which most people do. So there are no issues trading into US markets at all.
Yeah. So I guess what I'm really referring to is in the United States, we have what's called the pattern day trader rule, which means that you have to have 25,000 in capital. And if not, you're not able to buy in and sell multiple times a day. You get so many trades a week. I think it's three trades a week is what you get and in a rolling 5 day period.
Yeah,
So
we don't have
obviously.
that, and I think that might be related more to stocks. In futures markets, it's you know that we have a lot of traders in the US who are even retail traders who are trading 20, 50, times a day. It's expected. It's fine. There's a whole industry in terms of reduced margins. So the margins for day trading, for example, ES futures is smaller than if you hold it overnight. So there's a lot of brokers will let you day trade it for $500 margin. So that's what I'm saying about you work your money, more better that you can trade 40, $50 at a time profits and do that 30, 40, 50 times. If it's a one lot, if you think about that $500, you're working that really hard every day. So no, in terms of futures markets, no, you can trade futures markets as much as you want.
I didn't know that, honestly. I trade it all the time, but I've never traded options really. I think I've been in maybe two options trades my whole life, but I've been in thousands of stock trades. So
Yeah,
that's why I was
very
thinking,
different.
like, when he was sitting there saying, like, well, you were more or less scalping trades, I was like, that makes sense if you got a good strategy, but it wouldn't make sense for PDT people. So yeah, thanks for clarifying that. Okay, so back to the
And so
Norton
for
method.
stocks, it's not, it's a different world again. So it's more, the Norton method is really just for futures markets, not for stocks. In
Sure.
terms of like the fund, for example, we're quite systematic. So what we do is we will test ideas, and we have specific entries. So we're not always in the market. We have specific entries and exits when something happens that is, triggers something. So, the option price is going to need to be in an area where we think it's undervalued at that moment. And if that's the case, that will trigger it. We might sit on the side for a month, but then when eventually it happens, it's systematic. It says, yeah, at this moment, we think these options are undervalued. So we'll buy them. We might hold them for a week or two and then sell them when they're overvalued. And so with the hedge fund, we'll test, we'll have a theory, we'll have an idea, and we'll test that. And if it proves in testing that it's something to it, then we'll go and develop the rules accordingly, go into live trading. Hopefully, it still exists live trading, and then we will keep adjusting. But I think in everything, I always say in both of them, even though they're completely opposite ends of the spectrum, one of them's designed to trade in large size and might hold for a week. One of them is designed to trade in very small size and hold for 2 seconds. The one thing that they have in common is they are specifically trying to target something, right? There's some edge. If I do this at this moment, I do expect to pick up money more times than I lose.
Sure.
So You have to go in thinking, what is my edge? And I think a lot of retail traders don't really know that. You know, they all go on gut instinct or something, but there has to be, who am I better than at this moment? Who am I profiting from? You know, why is there some edge at this moment? You've always got to ask yourself, if I think this is cheap right now, why does everybody else not buying it? It must be something that you've seen and got. And you know, to your point before, which is a great point, you should be, everybody should be journaling and writing down reevaluation. I have that as one of the processes in the Norton method. Reevaluate every trade. What happened just now? Why were you right? Why were you wrong? And you know, as an analogy, if you're a golfer and you've just, you know, hooked your tee shot way left, right? Or are you just going to sit there and just do the same thing again on the next tee? Or are you going to think about, why did I hook the ball left? What could have happened? And hopefully, you know, you've been to a pro and you've learned the, you know, how to do it. And a lot of retail traders have never learned from a professional. So when they metaphorically hook the ball left in a trade, so to speak, they've got no idea why it went left, right? And they don't know how to fix their trade. And that's a big part of what I do, is to say, if this happens, it's because of this, or this. So in a golfing sense, you know, my golf changed when I went to a pro and asked him, teach me all the things. If I hook the ball left, well, it could be your shoulder alignment, it could be your grip, it could be, you know, your feet were slightly closed, etc. So then I can go through a checklist, right? And then I can adjust at the next tee. And then if I adjust my feet, for example, and it still hooks left, I know it wasn't that last time. And you go through that process, but there needs to be a process. And most retail traders don't have that. And frankly, like, I've tried to learn golf on my own because I, you know, I watch videos and I watch the telly and I watch people. You can't. You have to go to a pro to learn the fundamentals to basically get that point where you can adjust because you understand what's happening. I think it's the same with trading as well. But journaling, reevaluation, that's the process that you must go through. Why did this happen? Otherwise, you're just going to do the same mistake again.
Yeah, my method, or well, I want to say method, but my sort of trade plan consisted of basically when I journaled, I could go back and say, okay, I lost on this trade. Was my mindset going into it a contributing factor? Was how I was reacting while my trade was on, was that a contributing factor? And if those were consistent and I'm still losing, then I could look at it and say, okay, well, maybe the markets are bad because of some piece of news right now. So maybe that's one of the reasons wrong. So the pattern itself, whatever I'm trading, my trade idea, maybe wasn't wrong. Maybe it's the markets that was wrong. So may now it's time for me to exit, leave, and sit back and watch, gain more data for a week. And then come back, and whenever there's healthier trades happening, my specific, I guess if you want to call it a specialization, with trading with small cap stocks, with trading psychology entered in. Let me make an example. When Ukraine was getting invaded, everybody knew it was going to happen. Russia kept saying, we're not going to invade. We knew it was going to happen. We're seeing the military gear. Some people were saying, well, they're just trying to scare Ukraine. I was like, I don't really think so. So let me see how this looks like from a trade perspective. So immediately, two things came to my mind when Ukraine got invaded, and that was oil and grains, because I was looking at the exports coming out of Ukraine. And I was like, okay, well, if they're in war, they're not going to be exporting as much. Now, it doesn't really matter if Russia allows them to still export 6 months down the road. I'm looking for those first couple of days during the invasion when the height of the volatility and just everybody's going crazy. So what I did was is I entered into a stock called HUSA. Whenever I it stands for Houston Oil and Gas. For us stock market guys, we look at ticker symbols and we usually attribute a name to them. It's just something that we do. It was trading, I want to say, at a dollar or two. I made 300% holding it overnight. But I was also holding a grain stock, and I don't remember which one it was. It was small cap, and I lost like 10% on it. It never went anywhere. I couldn't figure it out. But I made a lot of money. I made a lot of money on that. And I did that throughout my career, whether it was not with GameStop. I never traded GameStop. I traded AMC. I traded NAKD. That one was a big one. When Trump came out with the SPAC for Truth Social, I made a pile of money on it. It was up 300 or 400% in a couple days. Of course, it was a SPAC, so it comes out at $10, and they release it in pre-market. It was like, I want to say $13 or $14. So we're like, man, this thing, it's really only worth 10. It's a little high. And I was like, listen, guys. And then there's going to be a bunch of correlating stocks. Another one that was right there with it was another Trump sympathy play. It was a security company that was working throughout all his hotels. So it's really just trading off of people's psychology. And this continued to work. I never got the first one though. Everybody always thought that the first stock that goes up, if you have a stock that goes up 300 or 400%, it's probably because of people gambling or something happened. But the next couple that trails it that comes with it are a lot easier to see. So you have GameStop, you miss that. You've got AMC and AKD. You've got a pile of other meme stocks that haven't moved yet that you're able to get in with a little bit less risk with huge upside potential. So that's basically what I did for 4 years.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, no, trading the followers is always easier than trading the leading ones. So
Yeah.
if you can identify that this stock follows this stock or this market follows this market, then that's obviously always a lot easier, and that is certainly something that people should look at.
Always made it an analogy of a balloon. If you blow a balloon up and it has a string coming down, you can see the balloon going up in the air, but the string's still on the ground for a little bit. But you have time to grab a hold of that string for a little bit. You just don't want to get, I mean, it's risky because it's extremely volatile stuff. And from the sounds of what you're doing, especially with the Norton method, you're not in as volatile positions. But I want to ask about the volatility of options. What kind of volatility ranks are you looking at? Are you looking at things that can drop or gain 50%, or are you looking at things like in the 5 to 10% range?
Usually, the markets that we're looking at, the option prices are not moving that much, right? So if you're looking at things like NQ options, for example, and we'll be looking at some that we don't expect, unless the NQ has a big day. If it moves 4 or 5%, then yes, options are going to move. But again, we're looking to hold something over a period of probably a week or so. And again, with a hedge fund, we're not necessarily expecting or thinking we're going to be making 300 or 400%. It's just not the game we play. We don't think that's really edge. We're just trying to grind out. This at this moment is a little bit undervalued. If that trade, most hedge funds, frankly, you're looking to make in the region of, between 1 and 2% a month. If you're a traditional finance hedge fund, 1 to 2% a month, okay, somewhere in the region of 12 to 20% a year. Now, of course, retail traders are thinking I can make hundreds and hundreds, but it's very different when you're trading in bigger size and in a different way with other people's money. And you want to just be consistent and consistently hit, a reasonable target. So we're not trying to necessarily make big amounts. And again, to people who are, for your listeners that are still thinking, they're going, oh, well, why aren't you trying to make, hundreds of percent? If you're an allocator in the professional world, an investor, and you come, a hedge fund comes up to you, a trader, and says, I can make you 100%, 150% a year. No one's going to believe you. And the chances of you being able to scale that into a $50 million, $100 million, $300 million fund is virtually nothing. If that sort of edge was there, it's very different trading with, a small retail account, and that's where the, Norton method's different, right? You could have a $10,000 account in the Norton method, and you can grind that potentially if you're good at it. You could be making $1,000 a day or whatever or more, right? So that you think about that return, right? You think, oh yeah, look at this return on percentage terms, it's amazing, and it is, but it can't be scaled into a hedge fund just because of the way it operates, right? And you can't. In the NQ futures, for example, you can't really trade more than 5 or 10 lots, right? Which is only needs like a $20,000 account or so. So it's a different game, a different game. In that sense, we're not trying to make those huge amounts. We're just trying to grind out, bits of edge here and there.
For me, I just traded stuff that I didn't have like you say, the size that you were trade that you're trading with. I was trading stuff with under a $50 million market cap. So it is extremely easy, those type of stocks, to manipulate price wise. You're not going to manipulate a 10 to 15% change in a $1 trillion company on the stock end. And I'm sure options are probably similar. So if you don't mind, let me ask you a few more questions. You got time? Yeah, awesome. Okay. So was there anyone that was such as a mentor or a favorite trader of yours that you had whenever you were first entering into the markets?
Yeah, I mean, when I first entered the markets, I was a very much a junior on a desk. So I joined a investment bank when I was 18, and I was the lowest guy. And I looked up to this, relatively young trader. He was about 23, and I became his assistant. And I looked up to him until I realized that actually he wasn't very good. He'd only made money. He'd only made money because the stock market in Japan had been going up, and then as soon as it started to crash, he, like everybody else, lost. So at that time, I got given a trading book when I was 19 by an investment bank, literally 6 months after I left school. And I had no one around me on that desk who was any good. And in fact, the fact that I got this trading book when I was so young, there was a lot of animosity towards me for getting this. There's a whole story behind that, how I got the book. And it's not because of connections or anything. It was nothing to do with that. I don't have any connections in this. This was in the city of London, by the way. I'm from London originally.
What was the
But there
book
was no
name?
one there that there was no one there that I could learn from. So at that moment, I had to learn by myself. I had to learn on the run. But that was fine during a crash of the Nikkei in 1990. This was so, but that's fine. You sink or swim, and luckily for me, I was able to swim. From there, I did have a very good mentor. After that, I moved down to the London Futures Exchange to be an options market maker, and I had a very good mentor there, an American guy. In fact, my biggest regret was I didn't work as closely with him and as long with him as I really would like to have. So there was an American guy who actually backed me. So he taught me options and he provided the backing for me to go and be an options market maker. He was a fantastic trader. And over the next decade or so, I interacted with him a few different times. I really didn't learn enough from him. I could have learned more, but he was excellent. And then basically over the decades I've been in, you just develop a group of people around you that you trust, that you believe in. But you definitely need people at some point to learn from. Trying to work out, as I said, it's like trying to work out how to play golf on your own. You can get to a reasonable level, but re realistically, you're never going to get to a level, like in my case, I'm competing against Goldman's and Morgan Stanley. You're never going to get there without having good people around you that you can learn from. So for example, my first investment bank, the Japanese one, during the crash, there were some layoffs at Merrill Lynch, and my firm employed two guys from Merrill's. Now that was fantastic opportunity for me to tap into what was happening at a US investment bank. So I learned a lot from those guys. And again, everybody I met who I thought had information and knowledge that I didn't have, I'd sit down with them, teach me, tell me, tell me. And that's how I became good in that market. I became, I think one of the best traders in that market, without trying to be arrogant, but that's just the fact. My P&L showed it. But I just kept trying to be better than everybody else, just learning more. There's always something to learn. So yeah, you need people around you that you can help you always.
The markets, you got to be extremely, I always thought, ambitious, but you got to really love it, because if you don't love it, it's going to destroy you. It's going to, everybody gets humbled. Everybody has a losing day in the markets. And what was the book name that he gave you? I'm interested.
Sorry, the book name?
The book name when you were that you were given, I believe you said when you were 19.
No, I was given a trading book means I was given control over a trading book from my bank. So,
Oh, okay. Yeah, I missed that first word there. Yeah. I thought you were given
Sorry.
like a physical book, like a doc, like,
No, there
autobiography
was
or
no
something.
formal training then, actually. Like as a trader, you basically were just chucked in and learned to swim. Although saying that, over the next sort of year or two in that bank, because I was doing so well during that crash and everybody was struggling, my bank asked me then to basically start teaching and teaching everybody else. And actually that became a theme of mine. So I was at a number of investment banks in London over the years, and I delivered training courses at every one, which is why, teaching in the Norton method, I've taught traders since I was nine, literally since I was 19 years old. I've taught traders. So it's something that actually coming from London, where trading is, if you're in that trading world, it's kind of like part of your role is to pass on your knowledge to the next generation. That's why London's been a hub of trading for, hundreds of years. So we always, view the idea of trading, training up new traders as part of our role, really.
Is there a special piece of literature as it relates to stock or options trading that you would recommend everyone read?
Not necessarily. No, I don't think necessarily. I think that there's a number of different. Yeah, there's nothing in particular that jumps out at me and says you must read this. It tells you the Holy Grail or anything like that. Not particularly in options. Just get a balanced, a balanced view of the options market. And be careful with that. The influencers telling you to sell options. Really be very careful. There's another side to that story. And they're not telling you it. So be very careful on that.
Always liked an investment quote that I heard, and I'm going to butcher it, I'm sure, but it was, "The market can remain wrong longer than you can remain solvent." And as it relates to that quote, there's a book that is a really old book that I really like for people to read, and that is Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. And what that book does is it's a historical, it gives historical annotations to really crazy events throughout history where people were just totally wrong about a large thing. So thank Tulip Mania for those of you that aren't familiar. It goes into a lot of other things, the Sorcerer's Stone, that sort of stuff. Stories throughout history that's gonna make you wonder. So when you're looking at that GameStop stock at $200 a share, and you think you're hit, the FOMO's hitting you, please do not buy that kind of stuff. Someone's gonna be left holding the bag, as they was, and yeah, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. Excellent read. Tough read, but excellent. Just a couple more questions here. Why don't you walk me through a day that you really had a really bad day in the markets? Somewhere where maybe you lost a lot of money, or maybe the markets were just way different than what you originally thought. I'm sure you have with that many years in that you have a few stories probably like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's what's obviously important is that you learn from them. So actually very early on, so I got given this trading book to trade for this investment bank when I was 19, Japanese investment bank. And essentially I'm on, 3, 4 month probation period, right? And the backdrop is everybody on the desk hated the fact that I got given this book. I was the youngest and newest on the desk. So it was a very interesting time. The market's crashing. Everybody on my desk hated me for the fact that I got this job. And I was doing all right. I was doing pretty well. I was learning some lessons. I was going okay. And then this interesting situation happened that we had a new manager on the desk who had a very big reputation, just came over from Japan, actually, had a very big reputation. And he wanted to show us, basically how good he was and what he knew. And he came around to us as traders on the book. And on my book, he pointed to a few of the stocks that I was trading and said, I want you to buy a few hundred of these, few hundred of these, few hundred of these, few hundred of these. And the idea was that in, they would go up a bit and then I would give them to him essentially onto his trading book. Except literally within a day or two, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. So this was 1990, and the market crashed.
Oh man.
And I sat there on this day. My loss was about $100,000, which in 1990 was reasonable money. And what made it kind of worse for me, obviously, was that most of the loss was actually on these positions that they weren't mine anyway. And this was an interesting point for me because at the end of the day, I had to go and see the head of the whole trading floor. very, a guy that you were kind of fearful of, right? The guy that ran the whole trading for. And I had to go and explain why I'd lost this amount of money. And, I'm on probation, and I felt at that moment, this could be it for me. This could be my last day. And, I thought, what can I say? What can I say? I didn't want most of these positions. I was told to put them on my book, right? But I also realized that if I said that as my explanation, I just looked like somebody just, passing the blame. So I went up, I was petrified, frankly, and I sat down with the head of the whole trading floor, and I just said, I'm really sorry. This war happened today. Obviously, Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, stock market crashed. And obviously, no one knew that, right? And I just said, look, I'm really sorry. I didn't blame the fact that they weren't mine. I think about 60 to 70% of the loss were on these particular things that I was being told to buy. But I took the blame. I said, it's my book. I'm really sorry. But what I will do, I will learn from this. I will learn from this. And I promise you, I will learn from this. I will learn lessons. And I will improve. And you know what? The biggest lesson I learned there really was, which I didn't say at the time, was you don't have anything, no trade, no investment that you personally don't want. If it's in your trading account, don't blame someone else as, oh, my broker told me this, or someone's, don't you accept responsibility for everything you have. And in this case, so a few months later, the same guy came up to me and said, oh, Gary, I want you to buy this and this. And basically, no, if I don't want it on my book, if you want it, it goes straight onto your book right now. It's the same thing. If you want it, then you have it. But so that was a lesson that I learned, in terms of I couldn't learn from the fact that, this war happened out of nowhere, that no one expected it. So there's nothing really I could do there, but there was a lesson to be learned in only have things that you want on your trading book, because there's nothing worse than say, having this loss and thinking, I didn't want that anyway. That's horrible. And, again, I see it from people. You're looking for someone to blame. Everybody's looking for some, oh, my broker this or this person that. If it's on your book, it's your responsibility. That's it. If you buy a stock on your account, it's your responsibility. Don't blame anybody. It's no one but yours. And so that was a good lesson to learn. It was a good lesson about taking responsibility, which I did. And I think if I'd have blamed him, I probably would have got sacked that day. If I'd have said, this guy told me to do it, they probably would have said, you're blaming someone else. But one of the reasons I got the job was because of humility. I'd shown humility in certain circumstances. And they liked the fact that during a crash, the markets needed someone that said, basically, I'm not all, the be all and end all. I'm not amazing. I will make mistakes, but I will learn from them.
The thing that sticks out to me with this particular trade is losing 60 to 70%, but the year sticks out big time because it seems like to me that you wouldn't have lost that much if you were trading like the 2010s, because you would have had a trailing stop loss, a stop loss, some kind of hedge to keep from losing 70% almost on a trade. How did that look in the 90s? Could you even put stop losses on stocks in the 90s?
So in this situation, I was a market maker. These things just collapsed. There was just no, and it was just bedlam. It was absolute mayhem. So imagine it's just a crash, right? So there's no, I did hundreds of trades that day. I can't even remember how many trades. I did hundreds of trades. It was just a nightmare. I was a market maker of 115 products. They were actually like essentially derivatives of Japanese stocks. And I was just making trades. Just it was a crazy day. But definitely in terms of risk management, it was nowhere near what things are now. Okay, nowhere near. And so if we go forward in my career, again, I would never have a large position in anything now without having some way of hedging it or hedging it. So it doesn't, in what we do in a hedge fund, we don't tend to have that kind of risk. But in other ways, if I'm building, so even for example, in my personal investment portfolio, as your portfolio grows, there are times. And so, for example, a few weeks ago, I got nervous about the stock market, so I hedged my portfolio. I bought put options and hedged it, and that's definitely something that As the 90s went on, you become a lot more aware of hedging, and that actually became a specialty of mine. So in investment banks, I became someone, would be trying to hedge the risk for the whole department or the whole floor, being involved in that decision making of how do we hedge certain risks. And that's essentially how we started the hedge fund, really. We're trying to help investors protect their risk. So definitely the risk management, again, risk management in the 80s and into that wasn't a big thing. You had big up days, big down days. It was all a bit crazy. But as
It
my
sounds like
career
the
went on,
Maldives.
I don't want days like that. Again, another thing I learned, I don't want a day like that. I don't want that exposure. I don't want to be, again, what we said at the start about selling options. I don't want a day where I come in and it's like, I'm smashed. No one wants that. I've seen it. I've seen it in trading desk. I've seen it. And it's a horrible feeling. It's a horrible situation. So try to work out a situation where that's not going to happen to you.
Yeah, sure. So I got to ask, because you mentioned it, what made you nervous a couple weeks ago with the markets? Like, how are you seeing the markets right now today?
Probably the most concerned I've been for equity or risk markets since COVID. I think no doubt about that. And really, it's about the fact that, and this is, I don't think it's just me. I'm hearing a lot of professionals. There just doesn't seem to be a coherent policy coming out of the administration. And that's not political. I'm not American, right? I don't vote for either party. I don't care about either party, but there's just not a coherent policy. And investors are effectively saying, we don't know what the end game is here. We don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty. The reality is tariffs and trade wars, they hurt economies. No one wants them, right? America introduced tariffs and trade wars in 1930 as a response to the recession and the crash in 29, and it was a disaster. Okay. It prolonged the depression. It created the depression worse. And I think right now is that people don't know what's the end game here, because we're hearing conflicting stories. And when investors don't really know what the theme, what's trying to be achieved here, the best thing to do is just say, I don't want it. And you've seen that in the stock market, right? It's just fallen, what, 10% in the US. And even now, it's fallen 10%, but it doesn't feel like there's people saying it's cheap, I want to buy it. Until there's something that we can put pin and say, okay, this is it. This is what we're trying to achieve, and this is what we're doing. People are going to be a bit scared of risk right now. So
From my point of view,
it's nervous.
from my point of view, I think that we're on the brink of a possible, what I would call a technological revolution with AI and things coming into play now. But I think that the risk is that between America's debt and also the volatility in our politics is really going to hinder that. That's putting a roof over what could possibly happen with the technological revolution. That's just, don't take my word for it. That's just my perspective of it. Uncertainty is definitely something that hurts markets. I agree with that 1,000%. Do you think that tech is in a bubble right now?
I think people are reevaluating that AI story that you just mentioned. I think that investors are reevaluating it in a number of ways. What is to come? Obviously, DeepSeek, when that came out in January, that changed the game. In terms of it uses far less energy, for example, so that affects the energy situation. It was far cheaper than we thought, so that means it can be replicated, that kind of AI technology. And I think it got people, obviously valuations of the AI space, like Nvidia, were at high, very high levels. It doesn't mean it's not going to be something. It's a bit like Cisco in the late 90s, right? Everyone's going to need Cisco's infrastructure, no doubt about it, in the dot-com world. But is that valuation sustainable? And DeepSeek, I think, made people, investors, start to think, I'm maybe paying too high a multiple here for this AI stock. And I think they're still trying to reevaluate where value is in that space and what the future is. So until they find a level where they think it's better, then I think that's a scenario. People are still trying to find where value is there. But these stocks were very expensive before, so I don't think it's a surprise that there's been something there. It's just a case of now, what's the next theme? And again, if an investor, so the AI theme drove particularly the Nasdaq for the last sort of couple of years. The question now is, what is the theme that's going to drive the market now? What is it? And in fact, because of the situation, Europe's got a theme. Europe's had no theme for 10 years, and Europe has underperformed the US for, a decade, right? European stocks. It's been a disaster for an investor, right? But because of the changes now, and because of the US basically pulling out of Europe in a sense of trying to being, an active participant in NATO, for example, Europe's now got a theme. They announced a few couple of weeks ago, we are going to rearm, and we obviously got to do it more of ourselves now. Now investors have a theme, and you can see investors piled into it. If you have a coherent story and a coherent theme, investors will go to it. After DeepSeek came out, investors, started to put a lot more money into Hong Kong and Chinese stocks. The question now is for America, in order for this stock market to bottom and then flourish, we need to know what the next theme is. What is it? And we don't know what that is yet. Tariffs themselves and trade wars don't help anybody, don't help any stocks, and
It's not
consumers are
helpful.
just going to pay more for everything. And that's, I think, the situation. Obviously, they'll try and put tax cuts through at some point, of course. But that in itself, it's a story for down the line, but I don't think it's enough that's going to suddenly make investors turn around and want to pile in. So there needs to be something. And until I think investors see what is this theme, this reason that we're going to buy, whatever it is, then equities, I think, are in a difficult spot right now.
Where do you see good value at outside of the US?
I think it's
Emerging
probably in
markets.
Europe, I think it's probably pushed too high for the short term. And it's always a risk buying into Europe equities, but there are some very strong companies. I do quite like Hong Kong, China right now. I do visit China a fair bit. And they're st but it's a notoriously difficult place to invest. Notoriously, investors have got hurt there a number of times. But if you look, for example, at their cars, their electric cars, they are amazing. They are way ahead of most things that are being produced elsewhere. They could way dominate that, and I think that's more of a risk for Japan, for example. But I think certainly, Chinese EV manufacturers are on a different scale to everybody else. They're producing amazing cars. So I think, I think generally right now people just want to be diversified, and you're seeing that, right? So after 10 years of US outperforming, German and European stocks comfortably over the last sort of 2 months or so, you're seeing European stocks outperform US dramatically. Now, that's a massive turnaround, and that's incredible, really. And the same, most markets are outperforming the US.
So it
I will
seems
never
like
back,
that.
by the way, I'm not, I'll never back against the US if things are allowed to run normally. It's an incredible country. I love America. I come travel there a lot, all right? It just, right now, there is nervousness, and we need to have a new theme. What is that theme going to be?
Absolutely. And the US, one of the biggest problems I see outside of markets, I guess, is housing prices. A lot of times people are making, $40,000, $50,000 a year. Houses are $250,000 to $450,000 a year. The affordability is worse than 2008, and we actually have the worst housing affordability that we've ever had in the history of our nation per capita. So it's a huge problem. Huge problem. We got
That's actually a
800.
global problem. So to put it in perspective, I think Australian house prices are, so I think the average salary in Australia, might be wrong, I think it's like 70 or 80,000 Australian dollars. The average property in Sydney is over $1 million.
Yeah, I mean, how can you even think about affording a house like that,
So this is a global issue. There are certainly some, that the housing market globally is, house prices are out of reach of young people trying to buy a house, and that is something that needs to be corrected. And yeah, there's all sorts of things we could discuss there, but there are things, and it does seem unfair for the younger generations that they can't get into the housing market, and it was much easier than before,
I just had a
much easier
trading
before.
thought. We'll share this trading thought live because it literally just entered into my mind. So think about the younger generation not being able to afford houses. So who are they living with? They're living with grandma, grandpa, they're living with friends, they're living with mom and dad. So now they have expendable capital. I wonder if that isn't driving some of these digital currencies, the more the more BS digital currencies, I guess you could say, small cap digital currencies. I wonder if that's what's fueling it, the younger investors who are using that capital there instead of on homes.
Yeah, look, they've got nothing to lose, right? They need to make money quickly. They want to make money quickly. So I think they are chasing to some degree that this is the way they see that they can make money. They see a few people in that space, who've done well, and they think they can chase it. I feel for them. I have two kids in their 20s, and I know it's not easy. In Australia, they have it's not officially, but there's a term called the Bank of Mum and Dad. And if essentially, kids are turning to their parents, right? The parents are because they need for a deposit. The hardest thing is to save a deposit. If a house in Sydney or an apartment is $1 million out on average, you're going to have to save probably $150,000 to $200,000 deposit, right? You don't want to have much more than an 80% to 90% mortgage. So just saving that, how long does that take people? If you're earning $80,000 a year, and you're paying rent, and you're paying how is this? It's a terrible situation. So it's global, and I know it. It's in many countries, it's the same. And I can understand people being discontent, but you have to be, at some point, governments will need to address that, but I don't know how. And certainly, for example, tariffs on lumber that may increase the price of lumber in the US is not going to build more houses. You want to reduce the price of lumber and bricks and everything, right? And steel and all those things. You want to reduce the prices if you want more houses built. So raising the price of all of these goods is going to do the opposite. It's going to make it more expensive to build a house. So again, I don't see how that those policies, and again, investors are seeing the same thing. How is that policy going to help, put people into houses?
I would have personally, I would have rather seen interest rates raise above actual inflation instead of going by what I call, well, the CPI is a joke to me. But I would have rather seen interest rates raise instead of tariffs. It seemed like to me that whenever we raised interest rates, Jerome Powell just didn't have the guts to raise them. And I'm not saying necessarily to like the 70s level, 20 to 30% interest rates. That would be catastrophic for every market in the world, probably. But he just never raised them enough to get actual inflation down. We have a number, it's like, I think, what, 4% right now for the CPI. You would probably know before I would. But actual inflation is so much higher for the consumers. I mean, basically any good besides gas, besides those type of commodities, have more or less doubled. And houses tripled. I want to mention one thing real quick. When you're talking about the nervousness of investors, there's something that's glaring in everyone's faces in the markets right now. That basically shows the nervousness of investors, and that's the commodities market. So we're looking at gold, we're looking at silver, huge. I think silver's closing in on $34 an ounce. To actually buy this could be closer to 37, 38. It's usually not a good thing when we're seeing precious metals go up to that level. It means that somebody's scared somewhere, so.
Yeah, and there's dislocation in those markets partly due to tariffs. If you look at when tariffs were announced, you started to see squeezes, okay? Because, so for example, if you look at gold, well, Canada's a massive producer of gold. There's a lot of, gold sitting in the US that will come from there originally. If you're going to slap 25% tariff on Canada, then everything goes up. So what happened was the gold was being shipped around the world quickly to get ahead of tariffs or move some of this gold around. And it's actually based on, for example, in gold, it's if that gold was originally manufactured or produced in Canada, even if it was sitting in London, it's still Canadian, it's seen because that's where it's sort of hallmarked. So there was a lot of dislocation. It's in silver too, it's in copper. There are squeezes, there are physical squeezes. There's more people than ever wanting physical delivery of these commodities. So this whole trade tariff war is causing dislocations in commodities markets, which is sending commodities higher, which again, you look at copper squeezing higher. How's that going to help lower the price of anything? Tariffs just increase prices for everyone. That's what they do. And that's not good for anyone because it will raise inflation potentially everywhere. So again, it's like this is the medicine that's being given to the economy is doing more damage. That's what investors think right now. And they can't see the end game because there are mixed messages. I'm sitting here, as I say, on the other side of the world. I see mixed messages, and I'm sure other investors do. I don't really know what the end game is. As I say, our investors are, showing with their money, right? They're selling stocks and have been for essentially for the last month and a half.
Yeah, awesome. One more question, and well, two more questions, and then I'll give you the floor for the final word. I guess, well, back on commodities, where do you think commodities have more upside potential or downside potential? Do you think they're overpriced, underpriced? Give me some opinions there.
Yeah, it's a good question. I am still, for example, gold. I'll be medium term still bullish on gold. I still think it's got higher to run. It's interesting because usually in a situation where people think there's trade wars, they think economies are going to slow down, right? In trade wars, it usually hurts economies. No one gets benefit. So in that sense, you could make a case that all of these commodities should be falling. But as I said, there's something else going on with the physical delivery, and it feels like they're going to get squeezed in the short term. The only one that I'm not a fan of is oil. I think oil is probably the one that will probably continue to go lower. I think I don't see a lot of upside for oil. But the other ones, gold in particular, I think is still going to go higher. I think that in the short term to medium term, that will continue to go higher. Copper, I don't think should be this high. I think copper should be quite a lot lower, actually. But the tariffs are basically dislocating that market, and same with silver.
Yeah, the copper will essentially make large scale electrical projects a lot more expensive. As far as silver goes, I'm pretty sure silver is used in solar panels, so that hurts green energy type of large scale products, I should say, make them more expensive. Gold isn't used in too much outside the jewelry industry, but it's used a lot for hedges. From a countrywide point of view, I like your idea on oil because of America's one of the could be the biggest oil producer in the world, but they've shut off the pipes. So if we go by Trump's words, drill baby drill, then I can definitely see oil going lower. So really, I can't. There's nothing there that I disagree with as far as your opinion. Awesome. Yeah. Okay. Let me give you the last word, and then I'll ask you a last question at the very end that I ask everyone. So, take 5 or 10 minutes, however long you think. Give me websites that you may that people can find you at, social media, books that you might have written, just pretty much anything. Plug away.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Well, firstly, thanks, Randy, for having me on. I hope everybody enjoyed it, and hopefully, help to put people on the right path. That's generally what I try to do, right? Help retail traders get on the right path because there's so much misinformation in this business out there. I love trading. You've got to be passionate about it. You've got to love it. It's a great industry if you do it and approach it from the right perspective with the right mindset. If people are interested in what I do, I have a couple of books. An End to the Bull is one, all available on Amazon. And also for those that want to understand why technical analysis doesn't work and why you're likely to lose, I've written a book called Exposing It called Technical Analysis Exposed: Why Most Technical Traders Fail. The Norton Method, nortonmethod.com, is where I have a program to teach day traders how to scalp futures. Again, a more professional style, very fast paced, so it doesn't suit everybody. Understand that. And then if there are qualified investors, our hedge fund NN Squared Capital is a hedge fund that specializes in uncorrelated or zero correlation to equities. I have GaryNorden.com. I have some, you can see a bit more about me if you want. And there's some articles and stuff like that. I'm on Substack. YouTube. I'm not a big public, I'm not a big person on social media, so I do have X Gary underscore Norden. I have a YouTube channel, but I don't expect me to be, tweeting every day. And I'm not a big social media person. Keep myself to myself most of the time. But if people have questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them. And yeah, just try to, help people understand what this business really is and put them on a good footing.
Yeah, awesome. I appreciate that. So that's NN Square, all capital. I am interested in that book, Technical Analysis Exposed. I've been a technical analysis person. One of my favorite books is actually on technical analysis. One thing that usually happens here with these podcast episodes is people write books, and I try to collect one from each person that I have on if possible. So that's totally up to you, but I would absolutely love to get a copy of that book. And if you could just put your name on the inside, if you wish, I can send you my address, and I'll certainly plug it away on all my social medias, and it might help to market that a little bit.
No worries. Technical Analysis Exposed is only a Kindle version, but I can send you a version of that. But an end to the ball. If you send me your address by email, happy to send you a copy of an end to the ball. I'll sign it for you.
Yeah, oh, man, I really appreciate that.
No
I've
problem.
gotten several, and everybody's been so kind, and I really get to network with a lot of different people from different professions, and it's just learning from people. So, last question. I ask everyone this question, and
Okay, this sounds ominous.
I'm totally open to criticism, constructive criticism. So I want to ask you, how did you view my approach in doing podcasts? Did you think I did a okay job? Did you enjoy your time? That sort of thing.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought you had some your questions were good. I think that they were. I don't know what your audience is, obviously. I think you're relatively new, so. If your audience are traders who are looking for information, retail traders, I think your questions are really pertinent for them. I think, and hopefully the answers as well are going to help put them onto the right path. So I think if that's what you are trying to achieve, then yeah, definitely. I think that they were good questions for that from the perspective of retail traders. Yeah, I think that, I don't go on many podcast, right? So I've been interviewed on three or four. I don't, I say I'm not out there in the world much on social media and that, but